Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Welcome to the VAT Full Year 2017 Results Conference Call and live webcast. I'm Shari, the conference call operator. The conference must not be recorded for publication or broadcast. At this time, it's my pleasure to hand over to Mr. Heinz Kundert, CEO of VAT Group, and Mr. Andreas Leutenegger, CFO. You will now be joined into the conference room. Thank you.
Okay. Good morning, everybody, to today's presentation of VAT's Q4 and full year 2017 results. Welcome here at the house zum Rüden, and thank you for joining in such a large number. We have today a presentation followed by Q&A, as usual. We start with Heinz Kundert, who actually, until today, is the acting CEO of VAT Group, followed by Andreas Leutenegger, our CFO on the financial part. Then we have, effective tomorrow, March 13, acting CEO Mike Allison, who joined us the beginning of the year, and he will give you then, of course, some views on strategic priorities and the outlook for 2018. With that, I would like to hand over to Heinz, and floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Michael. Good morning, everybody. Might be a very special event where you have two CEOs of the same company in front of you. Quite unusual. Again, the outgoing, that's me, and the incoming is Mike. At this point, I'd like to welcome Mike Allison, of course, full-heartedly, and I'm pretty sure that he is going to be a great successor. He's still a lot of room to do in our company and to bring it up. I have to switch myself, as I understand. With the seventh consecutive quarter of growth, we are looking back to a very successful 2017 since listing in April 2016. Needless to say that this was only possible thanks to a great effort by each and every employee inside VAT and the trustful relationship with customers, suppliers, and certainly our customers. Thanks to the extraordinary growth, VAT's market share could be considerably increased. The record performance was primarily driven by strong growth of our addressed markets, new products, and cost reduction. Production capacity has grown over 80% and reached 870 million Swiss francs measured by the end of the year, according to the run rate in December. The high vacuum content in semiconductor manufacturing has further increased due to technology inflections and augmented specifications. Finally, the prospects for 2018 remain positive. We see a continuous growth in all three dimensions, namely the chip demands, equipment growth, and new technologies. Mike Allison will tell you more about the 2018 outlook in an instance. Total net sales increased by 36% with an EBITDA of 215 million or 31.1%. 80% of revenue was generated by the valve segment, followed by global services with 14% and industries with 6%. The highest contribution to sales with +40% came from the semiconductor valve segment. The highest volume growth came from semiconductor businesses, where we took advantage of very high demand for the production of 3D NAND, DRAM, memories, but also logic devices, foundries, and ongoing technology inflections. Display showed healthy growth in high volume OLED and generation of 10.5 pilot production equipment used for large area displays. Besides Samsung, the main drivers were investments in China. After severe downsizing of the production landscape since 2012, the solar industry is now on a stunning recovery. In addition, technology inflections such as PERC, heterojunctions, and CHIKS. CHIKS is a compound of copper, indium, gallium, and selenide, are driving cell efficiency. The new technologies is heavily based on advanced vacuum solutions, where VAT is the undisputed market leader. Industry and research was profiting from the digitalization and shows accelerated growth in many applications such as automotive, medical, aerospace, large research projects such as fusion control, accelerators, and many more. The growth of end markets was based on the ubiquity of numerous existing and new applications, driven by the digitalization throughout the society. The highest demand came from expansion of data centers, followed by consumer applications, communication technology, and industries. This trend will also continue in the years to come as new product sectors such as IoT, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, e-mobility, and many more will further proliferate. The second dimension is based on further advancements to increase the performance of semiconductor production equipment with regard to zero particles and other contaminants, lowest vibration, thermal balance, smartness, and many more stringent requirements to meet future device specifications. In VAT, in 2017, we could capture more than 40 spec wins at key accounts for the next generation of production equipment. This ensures continued delivery of highest performing valves to the semiconductor industry beyond 7 nanometers and over the next 5 to 15 years and more. A change of the valve supplier during the lifetime of a certified production equipment is very rare and would result in lengthy requalification and skyrocketing costs for the OEM. Currently, VAT has more than 100 research and development projects ongoing to keep the technology going. Finally, the third dimension, a further shift to accurate and contamination-free manufacturing processes in vacuum will continue throughout many industries to improve performance and productivity. A prominent example is EUV lithography, which is newly using vacuum for their light source, and where VAT is practically the number one supplier for valves. Thanks to outperforming our competition, the VAT market share for valves has been further expanded. For all valves in all industries, including semiconductors, displays, solar, and general vacuum, our market share has risen from 41% to 45% in 2017, year on year. This is not including services. In case of semi and related, including display, solar, LED, and HD, this means hard disks, the increase was from 47% to 51%, and if you take just semiconductors alone, it went from 57% to 64%, which is the highest rate we ever had in that segment. The data, as usually, were levied by VLSI Research in the United States and preliminary, just because the Japanese fiscal year ends by end March 2018, so some of the numbers are not 100% confirmed, but according to VLSI, the data are quite reliable. Now, taking these numbers of market share increase in our sectors has led to, a remarkable enhancement of our competition, of our competitiveness, and you can see that it was measured in the last 4 years, the highest increase we had recorded. And our competition is, of course, also growing, but we keep it still under distance, so we are 8 to 9 times bigger, still bigger than the number two, which is now CKD. Maybe you remember in the last 2 years, we had first MKS as number two, and then we had SMC once as number two, and now it's CKD, and MKS is now the fourth position. So they're changing the positions on a lower level. So, as a summary, the results that we could deliver are definitely also for us good results, and we have kept our guidance and hopefully also your expectations. And with that, I give further to more details in financials to our CEO, Andreas Leutenegger. Thank you.
So, ladies and gentlemen, let's go through the financial figures. And we will use the same, let's say, cockpit as we used since the IPO. We haven't changed here the key ratios. Also, don't like to change every quarter or half yearly the numbers, depending on how good we are. So we keep it constant also if we have bad news. You saw, as Heinz commented, we grew 36% on the top line. Let's not forget we grew 14% in 2015, 24% in 2016. So this is another dramatic growth in 2017 to 692 million. Or in other words, that's a growth of 184 million. In the middle, I go through the KPIs quickly because I will come back and give you some insights later on. On adjusted EBITDA, 215 million. I would like also to already mention here what is adjusted. We have only one adjustment, which is hopefully the last one. It's 2.9 million for the IPO bonus for all the employees, which I commented on that. According to IFRS, we have to expense it over 12 months period. And that was already unchanged since half year when we reported the half year 2017 figure. So this is what we call adjustment, 2.9 million. Remained unchanged, as I said, since last mid-year. That means no further adjustments in the second half. On the top right, you see adjusted EBITDA margin. We have kept the margin at 31.1%. And already here, I'm going to highlight that actually, if you look closely, that the second half was actually at 31.9%, so almost 32% margin. Whereas the first half year was at 30.1% margin. EBIT margin, that we have added here on the cockpit, and I also come back why this is important. But we feel also we shouldn't keep an eye on EBIT margin, which we actually expanded by 2.5 percentage points to 25.8%. At the lower left part, you see the figures. They look on a first sight not so, let's say, exciting in terms of free cash flow generation. Is negative minus 15% up to 109 million, or let's say down to 109 million. Actually, I have to say, and I will explain to you why. But certainly, capital expenditures and trade working capital resulted in that. Free cash flow margin 16%, that was 25% in 2016, and free cash flow conversion down to 51% after 86% in 2016. Also here again, I will come back. Net debt to EBITDA 0.7 times, that was 0.9 times a year ago. That means if we had a small further deleveraging, and down to 0.7, which is a good figure at year end. And we kept the dividend, or that's a proposal to the HGM to keep the dividend at 4 Swiss francs per share. If we go in more details, then you actually see that on that slide, as I said, order intake is actually on a full year basis is 31% up, and the Q1 was 11%. If we look at order intake, please, it looks 11% might look a bit lower, or at the lower end, but order intake, let's not forget, is lower than, it's about one quarter, 3 months revenues. So the order intake in our business is not, let's say, an important, really a key indicator, as it is very short-term driven. And then it depends very much what happens in the last day of the month or the quarter, Christmas period, are there an order incoming or not? And in our case, orders usually, if a big orders, they come in 5, 10 or 15 million, and that of course makes a big difference. Is the order came in last week of December or November, any month, or is it beginning of January? So We will then report on the 17th of April. We will show you the order intake of the first quarter. So let's not be too nervous about 11%, or actually we are not nervous at all. It doesn't keep us up at night at 11%. Because also when you, the order intake of 186 million, you see on that slide, if you multiply that times four, for example, we are on a run rate of 744 million already. So without further growth, you already have revenues if you extrapolate that 744 million, which is already a growth versus the 692 million in 2017. So we should not forget the run rate going into 2018. Also important to note is if you look actually the order book, it looks a big increase from 122 to 166 million, but it's more or less exactly the number, the same number. In other words, it's 2.9 times sales or 2.9 months sales, which is same as in 2016. So the ratio in terms of sales has not changed. It's about almost 3 months sales, which our order book lasts. And again, this is about 3 months, one quarter. So this is similar to the order intake, very short-term driven, and it lasts 3 months. And the rate has actually kept more or less stable. In terms of revenues, we have grown 40% in the last quarter. In 2017, 40% growth, and I would like to remind you the growth rate throughout the year. Q1 was 42%, Q2 was 35%, Q3 we grew almost 30%, and then Q4 40% up. Also interesting is 692 million in terms of net sales. If you calculate that per employee, that's 409,000 Swiss francs. So one employee revenues per employee is almost 410,000 Swiss francs. That's relative in industry a very high number. And we have expanded that again from 387,000 in 2016. In other words, we have, despite the huge add-on of people, we have still were able to increase kind of a productivity or let's say the output for each employee. So 410,000 Swiss francs per employee is the revenue in 2017. If we look at the margin, the top 31%, we kept it flat. But let's not forget that we had, as we reported earlier, quite dramatic costs for the ramp. In terms of, one has to digest that. In terms of capacity, I'm talking about running capacity. That means if I look at December 2017 versus December 2016, that means the run rate at the end of the year, we actually have almost 80%, 80% additional capacity. And that also means going into 2018, we now have the capacity to capture future opportunities and future growth. So we have 80% additional capacity in terms of a run rate. We have hired 500 people, 507 exactly, that's 35% more people. We always said every third employee is new. Over 2 years, actually, we have added 64% of additional people. And this is the net amount, and I want to give you an insight what that means, creating costs when I talk about the margin. Last year, on a net basis, we hired 500 people. On a gross basis, that means people in and out, including temporary, actually we added almost 1,000 people. So that means the temporary, they come in, we have to give them a badge, and then they go out again, and maybe some of them are replaced, some are maybe underperforming. So our HR department handled per month about 100 people, in and out. So net is only 100. Gross, it's actually 1,000 people. It's an amazing number which our organization had to handle. That's why ramp-up costs, dramatic ramp-up costs, additional capacity. You can imagine we need consulting. We have shipping freight costs, for example. We were in a chaos last year. Almost everything was shipped by air and not usually by ship because everything was last minute. Our customers were waiting, and also that's quite some dramatic additional costs which we have absorbed in the margin. We kept the margin flat. Additionally, we outsourced more last year. Instead of, as you said, we always said we don't want to insource more, we want to outsource more. So the margin impact due to additional outsourcing is about 100 to 150 basis points on the margin. So because we move, again, for those who are not so familiar, we move operating expenses and depreciation charges above EBITDA. And that has an impact or had an impact of 100 to 150 basis points last year. And despite all that, we actually kept the margin stable. Good. Then if I move on, we have now newly included a sales bridge. You see the volume effect, the price effect, and the product mix effect. What we call product mix is for us everything which is a new or new, has a new number or the product specification have changed. In other words, what we cannot track in our system, the product which did not exist a year before. That's what we call product mix. That could be variations, changes, or entirely new products. And you remember, we always said over a three-year cycle, we have about two-thirds of the products are new. And the effect here is about 20%. That's 100 million. So 20%, that gives you roughly the two-thirds over a three-year cycle. So the volume effect was 20%. The product mix effect also around 20%. And then we have minus 2 percentage points negative effect from additional volume rebates to our big customers, which you also had to give away. So you see actually, yes, we have a price effect, but it is not dramatic in our case. So 40% volume and product mix, and foreign exchange impact was almost flat on a year-on-year basis. In terms of split by segment, on the left-hand side, you see valves is 80%, global service 14%, industry 6%. And we had a small shift from global service, about 200 basis points or 2 percentage points, was 16% in global service, down to 14% into valves, which was 78% a year ago and is now 80%. So actually, thanks to the very strong growth in the semiconductor, which is included in the valves, maybe the valves, we have four sub-segments included there. It's the semiconductor itself. We include the display business, the general vacuum, we call it the GVA, and the modules and motion components. These four sub-segments are included in the segment valves. On the right-hand side, you see the growth by region. Also there, we experienced a small shift out from North America. It was 35% a year ago to Asia, and that also confirms the trend. Heinz and myself, we always commented on that we will see and observe a shift to more direct sales in Asia. Or to Asia, and that's why there we had 3 percentage points additional sales in Asia up to 51%. Let me have a word also below EBITDA. If we look at EBIT, we rose by 51%. That's a big number. And the margin, as I commented earlier, the margin is actually up by 25%, sorry, 2.5 percentage points from the 23.3 to 25.8%. And this is why EBIT margin higher up. This is additional outsourcing, as I mentioned. We have a hit, or let's say negative impact on the EBITDA margin, about 100 to 150 basis points due to additional outsourcing. But that helps, of course, on the EBIT margin, which rose over proportionally. And as well, of course, the economies of scale effect you also see in the EBIT margin, which has driven that margin to 25.8%. Finance cost, 44 million, and that includes, and I will come back on the next slide, you see also in your handout, 38.3 million recycling or foreign exchange losses. Otherwise, if we actually exclude that, the finance cost would have been 5.8 million only on a full year basis for our financing cost year-on-year. So 5.8 million adjusted. And then we had, if I go move further down, tax rate is lower on that sheet or page here. It looks significantly lower, almost 10 percentage points. And you remember last year with 23.5%, it was actually above our, let's say, expected tax rate of 18%-20% because we had some non-tax deductible IPO costs included in 2016, again, which were not tax deductible. That's why the tax rate was above. And this year, we were able to capitalize some tax loss carry forwards, for example, in Malaysia and Romania, thanks to the good results. Additionally, of course, the tax reform in the U.S. also helped us a little bit here, having a lower tax rate than our guidance of or expected tax rate of 18%-20%. So earnings per share went up from 2.43 Swiss francs in 2016 to this year's 3.86 Swiss francs year-on-year. So let's have a word on the tax structure here on what happened. We explained that actually already at the half year, but I would like to remind us. We simplified the holding structure. That was, you see on the left-hand side, a typical private equity. It was a leveraged buyout. We had some Luxembourg holding. That's also disclosed in the annual report, and we simplified and cleaned up the structure in 2017. And before there was a private placement in U.S. dollar put in place by the private equity owners, and this we merged. You see that LUX III, Luxembourg number three company was nominated the reporting currency in dollar, and we had merged that and had to clean it up. And we already had before currency forex losses sitting in equity. Now in IFRS, if you liquidate the company, you close a company, you have to recycle these FX losses already occurred in equity through the P&L. So you book nothing else. You show it in the P&L, and you book it back in equity. So in equity, nothing has changed. It's just to show it two times. It goes in the P&L and back in equity. And that was the 38.3 million non-cash, had no impact, but of course, has an impact on earnings per share in 2017. On the bottom, you see actually if we adjust it. Again, I'm not very keen on showing adjusted figures, but I still believe one should keep that in mind when we report on figures that was from the history, was a cleanup, had nothing to do with problems or impairments or whatever. It's a pure IFRS booking where we have to show it again in P&L. It goes back in equity. So you see adjusted actually net income would have grown 129%, and earnings per share would be adjusted by 5.13 Swiss francs or year-on-year growth of 111%. Maybe already comment here. People may ask why is earnings per share growing lower than or less than the net income. That had to do with 2016. You remember we went public in April, and then you have to calculate the number. You have to weight the number of shares. So the year-on-year, the number of shares is not exactly at 30 million. That's why it impacts the earnings per share differently than the net income because the number of shares also has changed. Good. Let's have a word on free cash flow. I said on the first side, that doesn't look so good, but you actually see that the cash flow from operations, we were able to expand it by 10 million, 146 to 156 million. And we should not forget that trade working capital in a growth scenario, as we live like now, that even if trade working capital in percentage of sales, we kept it stable at 20%. That's unchanged. It actually was 20.2% a year ago. Now it's 20.1%, so it's a minor change. But when you grow 184 million on sales, as I commented earlier, That means 20% is sitting in trade working capital. So you can do the maths, 20% of 184 million, that's 37 million. And you could actually add that back on free cash flow. So free cash flow adjusted by additional trade working capital, again, kept the ratio, would be 192 million, or in other words, 32% growth on operating cash flow. So there's no other effect. It's just a sitting, the cash is deferred and sitting in the balance sheet. Then in terms of CapEx, also we reported we are at the end a bit higher than our guidance. We guided around 6%. Now we had 6.9%. The reason is twofold. Number one is we accelerated capital expenditures. I mentioned we have a running capacity of 80% higher than a year ago. Since we are optimistic in 2018 and 19 going into the future, and we will report back on that, it's the time to invest. So we have captured additional opportunities, so we ended up a little bit higher with 47 million capital expenditures. The big portion of that was in Switzerland and a smaller portion in Malaysia. In 2018, that will reverse, so more or less not much more capital expenditure in Switzerland. But as we ramp the new Malaysian facility, the most of the capex will go to Malaysia, and a smaller portion then also to Romania, where we have additional opportunities. On the right-hand side, free cash flow conversion, that's a result of the lower free cash flow. That's free cash flow conversion is always how much EBITDA we convert into free cash flow. And if we would, just to give you a bit some sensitivities, if we would have spent the same capital expenditures than in 2016, then actually the ratio, the EBITDA conversion or free cash flow conversion would be at 64%. If we would, that means at capex of around 4%. And if we would even flat the trade working capital in a base scenario, then the free cash flow conversion actually would be 75%. So that's what we always, what we give as a more or less informal guidance, that free cash flow conversion in a normal scenario, base scenario, is about 70 to 80%. So why is it lower? Again, is higher capital expenditures, 6.9 instead of 4%, and trade working capital of about 36 million. That actually reduces the free cash flow conversion. Good. In terms of leverage, also here, and I'm concentrating on the right-hand side of the chart, you see that we further reduce the leverage. We don't expect to deleverage any further. You know that we have a target leverage of one-time EBITDA over the year, huh? Because we have, I always call it the Toblerone effect. We pay the dividend, the leverage jumps up. We have a peak of about 1.4 times EBITDA. That's when we pay the dividend. In last May, it was 1.2. A little bit lower, because in May we also generate already some positive cash flow. That's about the peak, and the low is then, for example, after the, or just before the dividend payment, is about 0.7. So that's the range we move, and then we have again the Toblerone effect. When we pay dividend, it jumps up, and then throughout the year it reduces and we generate free cash flow. So I think 0.7 is a reasonable number. And I also would like to remind, this is thanks to quite a significant trade working capital build-up, and also despite capital expenditures, which is a high amount, 47 million, and also despite the dividend payment last year of 120 million, and despite all that, we could keep the leverage, the net debt at the low level of 0.7. Which means, as I said, around a bit lower than now, one times EBITDA going into 2018. Foreign exchange, a quick word here. We still continue with the 18-month hedging concept. We hedge on 18-month rolling basis up to 100%. 2017 was rather flat in terms of foreign exchange movements. You saw that in net sales we had almost nil impact. And I just want to show sometimes investors, analysts are interested to know the foreign exchange exposure. You see that at the bottom part of the chart, the biggest exposure is in US dollar. We call it the net exposure. That means the net cash flow. Huh? We always measure and manage on a net cash flow basis. It's 200 million. Japanese yen is second with 93 million in 2017. And in euro, we had an overexposure. That means expenses were higher than the income. That's why it's negative of 56 million. And that's the resulting is in the Swiss francs, the opposite, with 247 million. In case you try to sum it up, it doesn't sum up. There's a difference of 5 million. It's also clear I'm not showing you all currencies. I just warn you now already, sometimes people want to sum it up. But we have some more currencies than just the currencies I show you on the slide. So there's a small gap. If you want to add it up. Good. My last slide, also important, is the guidance. This is the long, or let's say the midterm guidance. Mike will then come back on the guidance on 2018. We made two small amendments, I call it, not even changes. To be transparent, we clarified the net sales growth. We added here over the cycle. We always communicate that and we talk because people always say you're, what we said, almost 10%, high single digit actually. If we take it correctly, we always, the people ask us, yeah, that's too low, you're but far too conservative. And then we always say this is over the cycle. This is what we understood all in here. We just added the wording here to be clear, high single digit over the cycle. And then we add a EBIT margin target of 33% by 2020. People always ask us what we mean with midterm, what we have done when we did the IPO 2016, and we always said 3 to 5 years, so that's in average is about 4 years, so we added 2016 plus 4 years gives you 2020. I always want to be full transparent. So we reconfirm what we had said at the time of the IPO. So there's no change, actually. We have not changed the years for the EBIT margin target. We just clarified it to be a bit more precise, as people always ask us, what does it mean midterm? Because for Heinz and then probably also for Mike, it's important that we don't change guidance and midterm guidance and KPIs. That doesn't create much trust. So we stick to the word. Overall, the guidance has not changed since at the time of the IPO. Good, that concludes my part here. Then, Mike, I think you're the next one.
So, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's I'm very proud to stand here this morning as the new CEO of VAT. For those of you who don't know me, I've been in the semiconductor industry for 33 years, mostly in technology, business development, marketing. I've worked in the technology side as a process engineer. I've also worked with a major US OEM for 20 years. Previous to this position, I was president of Edwards, who also play in the vacuum components business. Very similar footprint in terms of customers, technology, and technology drivers. So it's kind of a natural fit moving across to VAT. I'd like to thank Heinz for the transition we made. We went around the world, met our key customers, explained our plans for the future, explained the transition and what I'd be focusing on. And I think the reaction we got from our key customers was really fantastic. So I'd like to say thank you, Heinz, for that. So this is a very exciting time for semiconductors. We're at the start of a data revolution. Never before have we seen such volumes of data coming into our lives. You know, we thought social media created a lot of data, but when you look at the opportunities with smart factories, smart buildings, things like that, it's a totally different scale. And this huge amount of data is creating opportunities for silicon content. Not just memory and storing data in data centers, but also in processing. And, you know, with faster processors, more data, we get better at artificial intelligence. And that's helping solve not just business problems, but some of the large societal problems from healthcare, transportation, energy distribution, etc. And this is creating a massive opportunity for the silicon manufacturers, and that's good for VAT. You know, for example, a car today has about the same silicon content as a server, a high-end server. So you can imagine how much silicon content is in the automotive industry compared to historical levels. So really, first thing, the data revolution creating an enormous opportunity for the semiconductor makers. Most industry commentators are saying silicon growth. The top chart here is units. The red bar is our customers' revenues. You see a very positive outlook for silicon, high single-digit growth for the next 3 to 4 years. And if you look back at Q4, very positive record results from Intel and Samsung. And they're driving the OEM community, which drives our business. They're also seeing record profitability due to chip pricing. And if you look at some of the other ratios like CapEx to revenue and CapEx to profit, it's a fantastic time for our end customers to invest in further capacity. And this whole supply-demand balance in the industry, the chip industry, is really at a level we've never seen before. And that's driving a kind of unprecedented level of stability, you know, which is great. You can see on the right-hand chart here, not so many of the peaks and troughs. I mean, I've personally lived through 9 downturns. I'd be happy not to see another one. It's pretty stressful. But the good news is I've at least gone through that and know how to deal with it. So that's the first thing, very strong end-user demand. The next thing is vacuum CapEx. One of the great things as you move through technology inflections, for example, planar to 3D NAND, it creates a much higher requirement for capital equipment per wafer start. So in NAND, 60% more equipment required to make the same number of wafers. So that creates a huge demand for our valves. The same in DRAM and logic. As you shrink to smaller geometries, 40%, 100% increase in CapEx. We even see that trend in display going from LCD to OLED, over 400% increase. And the other key thing is the key equipment that's growing are things like etch and deposition, all vacuum-based applications. And, you know, as you go to 7 nanometers, we're going to see the introduction of EUV, which is also a vacuum-based technology, as is ALE and ALD. So this growth in capital equipment is really helping the vacuum-based equipment more than any other part. And we expect vacuum growth to go up from about 52% to 60%. So, you know, fantastic in that part of the business as well. So first thing, very strong fundamentals in the business. Second thing, the capital equipment growing has a very high vacuum content. The next question is, how do we harness that? If you listen to any of the quarterly results from Applied Materials, you'll hear them talking about solving the customer's biggest problems. If you listen to Lam, they talk about addressing the industry grand challenges. Same thing for us. You know, we are experts and have a pretty sophisticated model around about dealing with large accounts. I had that in my previous company. I have it here, VAT. And really, that's about improving our customers' learning rates, allowing them to develop equipment faster and more efficiently and better. It's kind of almost like outsourcing R&D departments, and to create that level of cooperation and trust and intimacy with our key customers, we have large accounts around the world co-located with these players. And this is not just account managers, it's applications engineers, it's engineers, people that can go work with these key equipment makers and get in very early in the development process to give them solutions that they wouldn't get with any other valve supplier. having that depth of knowledge close to our customers gives us a chance to win, you know, most of the battles, and also allows us to interface with the technologists we have back in Switzerland, you know, to get the right solution as quickly as possible for those OEMs. And it's that fast cycle learning rate that helps them develop equipment, and it helps us drive our business. So this is a great model. I'll be trying to enhance that over the next year by getting more resources closer to our Asian customers especially. Our North America model is working pretty well today, but I want to make sure we increase some capacity in Asia. The second thing is, you know, to make a valve today requires much more than just machining and design. There's a whole set of competencies that VAT have developed over the years. Heinz mentioned a few. It's things like sealing technology, contamination management. Contamination is especially important. That's ensuring we make high-quality valves with zero particles. One particle can kill a chip on a device, so it's very important that we have a very strong control over contamination. Also, things like material, high-speed control, these are all competencies that VAT has developed over the years, and we are absolute leaders in each of these. Now, the good thing is that some of the other sectors, close adjacencies to silicon, also require this type of technology and these type of competencies. So we can take that into the display sector, the solar sector, and the R&D sector, and that's allowing us to grow our business in those areas. You know, this year I'll also be looking at other adjacencies that we can grow the business. But again, VAT, great customer model, great competencies to develop the right valves for our customers. So my priorities for 2018, you know, continue the innovation journey that VAT has been on, make sure we have the right products at the right time. Continue driving trusted partnerships, get that intimacy, but at the same time, protecting our customers' IP. That's becoming very important. These OEMs we deal with are, you know, are competing with each other, so we've got to have good segmentation in how we manage the business to be a trusted partner and obviously help solve their biggest problems. Next thing is organization and people development. You know, you all know VAT has grown very fast. You know, I've got to make sure we have the right processes, the right people, the right talent in place to continue driving the business forward. And, you know, the team have done a great job getting there. When you look at the ramp they've done, it's pretty incredible, the number of people we brought in. But there's a lot of training, management development, leadership development that we've got to put in place, and also to streamline our processes. In terms of operational excellence, to get Malaysia up and running, it's important that we have a very strong base in Asia. Something like 70% of our product goes into Asia. So we want to be closer to our Asian customers. And then the last, making sure we grow our service business and try to optimize some of the adjacencies close to the silicon business. So that's my core priorities for this year. So just to summarize, I think you've seen a fantastic opportunity data generation, driving massive opportunity for silicon content. We're in a very strong position in the market. We have a great brand, and you know, during my visits to key customers, that was so obvious, the strength of our brand, the strength of our reputation in the industry. So that's very, very strong. I want to make sure that we drive service opportunities and the adjacencies. Our revenue growth, we are saying between 15 and 20%, obviously depending on the CapEx expenditure from the top players in the industry, and that's at constant FX rates. Our EBITDA margin progressing towards the goal this year of getting to 33% by 2020, and substantial increase in net income and EPS and CapEx to remain about 7%. So that's all from me. I think at this point I'll pass over to Heinz.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mike. So we will now go into Q&A, and we have
same routine as every year. We take a couple of questions here from the room, then we see whether we have some interested people on the phone with questions, and then we come back here. Maybe we just start here in the front. Michael?
Yes, Michael Ford, Bank Vontobel. A question on your guidance. Do you include any market share gains in the growth that you mentioned here, or would that be on top? Because you've been gaining so much market share. My question, the second question would be, what limitations do you see to your actual market share? Would be the first two questions.
Of course, the first question, it is included. Second question, take ASML. ASML has 90% market share in lithography. They're the only one left. Not sure that we can reach 90%, but there's still room to grow, especially because capacity is a key factor, and there's no company around, as you have seen with the size of the companies, that can manage the capacity that we need. Maybe Mike, you have another.
Yeah, you know, I think at this point we've had 4 years of unprecedented growth in the semiconductor industry, so trying to get a very close reading on capital expenditure for this year is quite difficult. So we put a bit of a range in there. But I think, you know, if the market's stronger, we're in a great position to take it.
Expecting to gain more share, is that correct?
I mean, you cannot interpolate what we have achieved. It was an exceptional year. We believe we can do more, of course, but it will not every year just go regularly 5 or 7% upstairs. This is but we definitely believe more is possible.
Then maybe just another one on the margins. You're talking about the 33% EBITDA margin target that you already had in the IPO, but you had significantly more revenue growth, and the scale is basically much larger than what you were implying at least 2 years ago. So why is there not structurally more leverage in the business model? What's the reason why your EBITDA margin has not more potential than 33%?
Yeah, I think I commented on that. Let's not forget, in 2016 we also had a mix effect, which I have now not reported on, where the display business has doubled. So I would say, look, since the IPO, what has changed is the mix effect, more display. So the overall mix. And last year, as I said, if you use only the outsourcing alone is 100 to 150 basis points. So if I look at that extreme, if you have 31%, you add 150, we are 32 point something. And then we had significant costs, as I said, the consulting, 80% more capacity. You know, we have to move machines. I give you an example. Alone, 1 million costed us. We have to overnight move out our lab. We have an own lab inside. We moved it to Rüti. We had to rent space, a factory. We don't get it overnight. We have to, you know, you need trucks. We moved the lab almost within days or weeks and make a decision that was $500,000 easy. You know, the truck shipping cost, if you have to pull down the lab and build it up again, and then you have to make it clean, everything. And then we moved the lab, we moved to Grabs, and then we have to move the lockup to Rüti. It was also about $500,000, and then you have rental costs. Just to give you some example, 1,000 people in and out. Our HR department could not handle that, so we had 3 people from a temporary office just handling people every day in and out. I mean, 100 people a month, these are 3, there are more, that we 50, there are 20 per day. 20 people per day coming in our front door, and you know how lean we are and how small. 20 people per day, you have to interview them, you need a contract, so we had to hire 3 people for almost a year just handling this stuff. So I just want to give you, these are all costs we had, 1 million on over 600. And then let's not forget, we have high variable costs. You know, economies of scale effect is the higher, the more fixed cost, the fixed cost ratio you have. We already have 2/3 variable costs, so the economies of scale effect is always lower. So that all together, yeah. So I would say we are not yet there, I agree, but we are moving this towards the 33. But I would say, looking at us, we are happy with what we achieved. So.
It is not a factor. This is the build-up of suppliers. I mean, not every supplier could build up as quickly as we did. They have reached their limitations, so we had to find new suppliers, bring them into the process. And of course, it's not easy to negotiate price reduction in a situation where the supplier says, listen, I'm fine with what I have. I'm not interested to build another building. If you want that, you can finance it, or you give me a contract over the next 10 years. So all these things are kind of additional costs that in a normal situation would actually disappear or be definitely much lower.
Great. Yeah.
I'm Schaden von Baader Helvea. I would like to come back to your sales growth guidance of 15 to 20%. I think we could argue that's really conservative when we look at the forecast from VLSI, seeing more than 20% growth of wafer equipment, and also taking into account your market share gains. For instance, last year you made 400 basis points that actually added extra 10% growth to the top line, if you make the math. So why are you conservative? Do you have still a bit capacity constraints or some other reasons?
Well, that's a forecast for the silicon side of the business. But if you look at the forecast for display and other sectors, they're much lower than 20%. So, you know, I think we gave a range that encompassed silicon display and general industry. So that's why we pegged it at 15 to 20.
Remo Rosenau, Neue Helvetische Bank. When you say that you expect a substantial increase of net income and EPS, could you confirm that that is based on the 154 million and not on the 115, because 115 is clear that it will be substantial. That is the first question.
You can confirm your understanding.
Okay, thank you for that. And the second one, we in the last few weeks, we could read a great deal about 5G in the media. Swisscom came up with a theme. Mr. Kundert always said that all your, you know, statements about future, the next few years, would not contain anything to do with 5G. So if it comes, what would be the potential impact for you, and what is your view on the implementation and the timeline of 5G?
That's a very tough question. In fact, we just attended a conference, and 5G was one of the topics. There's still a lot of challenges required for 5G. For example, within the grid of a single cell today for 4G, you need 100 5G transmitters, all with much shorter wavelengths. So you can imagine the countryside with a, you know, 100 times the amount of towers. So there's a lot of big issues in how it's implemented. The likelihood it will be, it will come into cities first in more of a cell technology. But I still think that's a little bit out in terms of trying to project the impact on silicon. I think the other things I talked about, data center growth, artificial intelligence, autonomous cars, we'll probably see a bigger contribution from them in the short term. So they're all great. They're all drivers of silicon. So when 5G does come, it will definitely have an impact.
Okay. Thank you.
And thanks. It's Jörn from UBS. Three questions, please. The first one is, I'm sure you have contact with the CapEx decision maker at Samsung, Intel, TSMC, etc. When you discuss with them, what is their rough thought on 2019? Just to get an idea here. Second question would be, please, Malaysia, you are significantly ramping up the capacity. Have you already qualified your key supplier base? Have you found them? Or do you still need to ship things from Europe to have the good yields in Malaysia? And the third question, you already touched on this one in the display, in particular OLED. This was linked to smartphones in particular. There was a strong ramp up in 2017. Is this slowing down now? Is this a turn in the cycle? This would be the three questions, please. Thanks.
Okay. First question, the major silicon players. In fact, we just had a visit from Samsung to HAG last week. First time we've had a visit from a key end user like that. It shows the relevance of valve technology, even though they're not buying directly from us, they're buying from the OEMs.
their guidance publicly was that it's going to be in a similar level to 2017. But they have announced a major new fab spend. I think it's like $30 billion over the next 2 to 3 years for their new fab in Hwaseong. So I think from what we see so far, pretty strong outlook from the silicon players. I think, you know, we should see that coming through in the second quarter especially. In terms of OLED, I think OLED for mobiles looks to be slightly over capacity, but apparently we've heard from some of the key players that the demand for TVs is very strong, they're seeing some investment in that area. LCD is definitely not dead. There's 7 projects under construction that will come in over the next 3 years. So still some pretty good growth in the LCD area. Regarding the production move, do you want to?
Yeah, I can give you. We are on track. We are ramping. As I said, we want to double again this year. And you know, this is a big to find new suppliers and to specify them. That's not a one-time event. It is ongoing. But so far, we always say it's a big challenge, but we don't have any major troubles. But it's not an easy walk. So I would say the answer is we are progressing as our plan. You know. I would say not much faster, not much slower. It's a challenge, but we are progressing.
Maybe an additional comment. We need, in many cases, we need the qualification of our customers because it's copy exact. And that sometimes is not up to us to speed up because we need the collaboration with our customers. The good thing is once you are in there, they cannot get out anymore. So the process takes a little bit longer. But we are on track, absolutely.
And when you speak to the end users, you answered in 2018. I know visibility is not the greatest in this industry, but when you make this, or when you have discussions with the end users for 2019, I mean, if you look on the fab plans, et cetera, you have confidence that 2019 will be another year of growth in the industry?
I think it's too early to tell yet. Visibility tends to be pretty good on the six-month level, so we're pretty confident there. But 19 is very hard to tell at this point. But with those end drivers that I talked about, the longer-term, 3 to 5 year outlook looks tremendous. And I think Applied Materials talked about that in their call, in not trying to forecast CapEx, at a quarterly basis, but more in the longer term trend looks very positive, but how it progresses month to month, quarter to quarter is quite tricky.
Okay. If there is no question at this stage in the room, then probably we go to a question on the phone.
First question from the phone is from Paul Moran, Northern Trust. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi there. Thanks for taking my question. I just had one on capacity utilization. I know that in the past you've said that you want to get to about 80% just to give you some wiggle room and prevent some of the inefficiencies. Where are you on capacity utilization at the moment? Are you still at 100%?
Yes, we are. We are at 100%. I would say 110%. We are still overstretched, but as you say, as you saw, we are also adding on a daily basis capacity. But the factory is fully utilized. I think the point is not the capacity utilization. The point is the efficiency. And in terms of efficiency, productivity, you can have 100% with a bad productivity, or you can have 80% with a very good, excellent productivity. There we still have opportunities. Yeah.
Maybe an additional comment. We have to be careful. We also need some burst capacity. We had a very terrible situation beginning last year where the market immediately took off, and we then came into difficulties to ship the required numbers of valves. So we need ideally some burst capacity in order just to make a quick decision on ramp ups as it happened in the past.
Understood. And just a follow up just on with respect to logic. I know that it's difficult to know where the end modules and equipment's going to end up in terms of I'm talking about semi product. Are you seeing any sign that things are starting to ramp a bit more in logic? I know there's not been much capacity added in the industry, but I'm just thinking about that's a lot more capital intensive. Are you starting to see that come through?
Yeah, I'd say we've seen quite a lot of movement in the last quarter. There's been a little bit of, I think, a mix change into logic. You know, we don't see it as much as the OEMs. We're fairly standard products across our OEM range. And but what I hear from the OEMs is that there's a definite switch in Q1 into logic and probably some more into Q2.
And should we, and just thinking about how, because we focus a lot on, I guess, looking at memory and bit supply growth, and that's reasonably easy to forecast. Well, not easy, but there are, I guess, consensus views about that. Do you think the relationship between semi-revenue growth at that group and bit supply growth in the industry, do you see a change in that relationship going forward?
Hard to tell exactly. I mean, if you look at Intel's Q4 results, you'll see they saw pretty substantial growth in their data center business. You know, so that's probably some correlation there between that and the memory market. In memory, prices are holding up into the first quarter, which traditionally is quite a low point. So I think that looks pretty good for 2018. There's also a lot of processing going into data mining presently, so we're seeing quite a bit of interest in that from the foundries. So it's quite hard to correlate exactly. But I would say the data center part, especially with Intel, you're seeing pretty big increases there.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
Yeah. Can we operate the next question from the phone?
Next question from the phone is from Philip Saliba, HSBC. Please go ahead.
Yes, I two remaining questions from my side. In terms of end market by regions, how do you see the development of China, how do you see the development in the memory focused markets like Korea, and the switch in between countries? And then in terms of CapEx, remind me if I'm wrong, we talked about 1.2 to 1.3 billion of total capacity by end 2020. As it seems, you progress very quickly on that end. Should we rather expect the upper end of this range as we move towards 2020? Thank you.
I'll take the first question in on China. You know, China, it really is the $100 billion question with the government subsidies going in there. We are definitely seeing growth in the Chinese end users. I think, though, it's going to be a very interesting few years watching how they're able to ramp. Developing a 60 to 100 layer NAND device is not easy. And some of the established players have had yield issues, as you've read in the press. So, you know, Chinese starting from scratch with no technology partnerships, that isn't going to be an easy ride, so I expect some bumps in the road. We're staying very close to the Chinese OEMs. The big impact for us really is, you know, will there be a new OEM come up in China, and are we close enough? And the answer is yes. You know, there is growth there. We've got a large sales presence in China, and we're making sure that if subsidies from China go to local equipment makers, that we're in a great position to take that. And we've got very high market share with the Chinese OEMs. So I think, you know, it will be a very interesting few years. Certainly the Korean players, I think, dominate right now in memory, and I don't see a change to that in the short term. And, you know, we're also seeing a build-up of Korean, Japanese, and American fabs into China. And again, we're very well positioned to help them on their journey.
Yeah, with In terms of the CapEx question, it's correct, and I would like to reconfirm the numbers. What we always said, or last year, was 700 million capacity in Switzerland, 400 in Malaysia, and 100 in Romania. That adds up to the 1.2 billion. I think you pointed up already there might be some upside potential because when you actually really look at it in more detail, then in, for example, in Switzerland, we are well beyond the 700. So that's reconfirmed. However, I also would like to remind you what Heinz just said 2 minutes ago. We also want to have 20% reserve in the game or burst capacity. So we don't want to run up to 100% capacity utilization or 110 going into the future. So it doesn't mean that we expect that to convert into sales one-to-one. So we also want to have a reserve in the system. But the figures you mentioned, we can reconfirm them, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, is there another question here from the room?
Hi, sorry, Eric from MindFirst. Three questions, if I may. The first one on China again. How far do your customers over there require local content? So would you require to set up your own capacities in China as well? Second question, on slide 26, you're showing negative growth in dollar terms for IC, and does this create pricing pressure for you as well, given that the numbers of devices are still increasing? And third question, just a clarification on through the cycle growth, your high single digit number, that's per annum, I assume, and what is the base here?
Which number, page number you said?
26 for the second question.
Maybe give you, from my point of view, an answer to the question of local content. I mean, you have to see the proportion of OEMs in China. We have actually three main OEMs. They're in the range of 200 to 400 million revenue. Just imagine that Applied spends $1.8 billion just for R&D. So to have a local content that plays a significant role in the next couple of years is almost impossible. There's also the question of IP. There's a minefield of IP around the technology. And what I heard is that even the Chinese are struggling. They need a technology partner to build up all these fabs. They need somebody who's helping them to sell the whole thing. And this is not in place nationwide. What I heard from OEMs is that there are three very serious fabs under construction, mainly for 3D NAND, and they profit, of course, from collaboration with external companies, be that OEMs or be that device makers. So local content at the moment is maybe a wishful scenario for the Chinese government, but very hard to implement.
I think the second question regarding the graph, I think this was a forecast from VLSI that showed a slight downturn in 2019, so we're just using that as our basis right now. Again, you know, they're always wrong with the forecast. Last year it was started off at 5%, ended up at 35%. So really it's hard to tell at this point what 19 is going to look like, but that's the, I think the overwhelming situation is unit growth, and you can see that from the chart.
Okay, here, next one from Michael again.
Maybe just adding to that, because you kept on saying that there are actually no more cycles, right, in the industry. And now you say that, you know, you have this over the cycle guidance, which implies that there are cycles and that actually we could see 1 or 2 years with negative growth, obviously, you know, if we take the average of your past 2 years and the high single digit. So can you just clarify once again what your view on cyclicality of equipment spending over the next 5 to 10 years is? Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, Mike has to express himself, but it's a question of terminology. What is a cycle? as you said, and most of the people still the cycle downturns in mind that happened in 2001 and thereafter, or 2008, and these times are definitely over. You cannot compare 2018 with 2001 and 2087 or something like 1987, because we had a couple of products. We had the phone, not even a smartphone. We had the PCs and maybe industrial applications and mainframe computers, and that was it. Today you have hundreds and thousands. I mean, Mike made the presentation on that. You have hundreds of thousands of cycles, and they compensate each other. So the question is how the entire market is going to grow. Of course, it's not proportional, because when you have 40 fabs to fill, one fab is 14 billion approximately, maybe even more, depends on EUV. Then they are not filled one by one. They're filled sometimes in one quarter. You have 10 fabs being filled or stuffed, and then next quarter you have only four. And then you have swings. A swing for us is not a cycle. It's just the way how these fabs are going to be filled. And of course, it could be that in the last quarter you have a downside swing, and then everybody believes that the next downturn is coming, and in the first quarter of the following year it's going up again. So we have to get used on the new term, nomenclature of what is a cycle. But I personally strongly believe that the big downturns, unless it's external external factors like Tsunami 2 or financial crisis 2, that we cannot influence. But from the industry point of view and from the drivers, we do not see these deep downturns that we had before. But we're going to have swings.
I think we'll also see seasonality as well. You know, you tend to get a big build-up of chips for Thanksgiving, Christmas, Chinese New Year. So I think we'll probably see a bit more seasonality. But I think the swings, we're used to 40, 50%. If you go back 20 years, you know, I think probably more in the 10 to 15% range rather than that level on a quarter-to-quarter basis.
Okay. Any more question here from the room? Okay. Operator, do we have somebody on the line?
No questions from the phone.
Okay. So with that, I would like to hand back to Heinz for closing remarks.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I hope that you have got answered all the questions that you had. Thank you very much for coming, and for me it's the last event of that sort, and I'm happy to hand over to Mike. I think Mike has convinced you, I'm pretty sure, that he's the right man, he's the man to run this company, and I'm totally behind him and support him as much as I can. I'd like to thank you all for the excellent relationship that we could maintain over the last 3 years. It was a pleasure to work with you guys. It was not easy sometimes. You had your own opinions, your own guidance. But all in all, we made big progress in the communication between investment community and media and the semiconductor industry and related. And for that, I thank you very much. And I'm pretty sure that we're going to meet again in a different constellation. But now it's on to the team here. And I'm totally convinced that this is going to be successful. Thank you very much for coming.
Ladies and gentlemen, the conference is now over. Thank you for choosing Chorus Call, and thank you for participating in the conference. You may now disconnect your lines. Goodbye.